Hello, and welcome to the Book Business Webinar, The Reality of Digital Publishing Transformation Projects, sponsored by rSuite CMS. My name is Dennis Wilson, Editor-in-Chief of Book Business and the host of today's events. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with the question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, but you can send them at any time. Please turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so you can utilize all the widgets at the bottom of the console. Your console is interactive. Click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn how you can customize your experience today. Here today to discuss the pros and cons and best practices for digital publishing transformation projects is Mike McGinnis, Senior Vice President of Digital Technology Services at HarperCollins Publishers. HarperCollins has embarked on a transformation project to meet their long-term publishing strategy, and Mike is here to share what they have learned. Mike has been the Senior Vice President of Digital Technology Services at HarperCollins Publishers since 2009 after joining HarperCollins as VP Application Development in May 2007. Mike has spent the past 15 years focused specifically on media and entertainment, delivering business capabilities relating to digital content services, including digital supply chain, digital asset management, web content management, e-commerce, and related business processes and technology spanning the entire content management lifecycle. So let's get started. Mike, please go right ahead.
Great. Thanks, Dennis, and good afternoon or good morning to folks, depending on where you are. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through our what we affectionately call our CDWF project, which stands for Content Development and Workflow, although at a later date it might get an actual name beyond that moniker. And I'll take you through a little bit about HarperCollins, the business case that set us off on this adventure, the solution, the team that's been working on it and continues to work on it, the approach we took, some lessons learned, and then we'll leave a lot of time at the end for questions. So moving right along, HarperCollins is one of the world's largest trade publishers, founded back in the early 1800s. We're headquartered out of New York. But we are a subsidiary of News Corp, but we do have divisions in the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, as well as India now. And we have a fairly significant list of authors from Mark Twain through Agatha Christie to Neil Gaiman. We also acquired Thomas Nelson, which was combined with our Zondervan Christian Publishing to form a HarperCollins Christian Publishing division. So the business case, basically the goal of our project was to tag content that would allow for new product development, new content and product development, and also drive new merchandising and marketing needs as we move towards online interaction with our consumers and our supply chain reseller partners. In order to develop new content and deploy it for both merchandising and marketing, we needed to be able to produce content sooner than just what the output for print was allowing. A lot of our digital products were basically coming off the back end of a print-based process, and most of the marketing collateral is also derived from those print-based assets. So for those of you working in publishing, you can imagine trying to extract content from final covers or samples from final interiors. We needed to deliver this multi-channel output concurrently. We also needed some transparency from a workflow perspective on where the content was at and what state it was in. And although we had a digital asset management system, that was much more focused on what I would call final truths or final versions of assets as opposed to things that were in development or other content that needed to be reused by folks outside of the content or product development teams, for instance, marketing, the marketing and publicity folks. We also needed to work across disparate participants, both internal folks and external teams that would collaborate on the content. And so we needed a system that would allow non-Harper and Harper employees to interact with the content, and just dislocated folks that were working at different sites. We had a set of tools, or have, I should say, because some of them are still in production, to support various aspects of these processes, but the legacy systems were increasingly harder to support in terms of making them compatible with new versions of other software, integrating with other new systems, and also just with new divisions. We had different divisions using different tools in different ways, and it was very difficult to scale and support the legacy system infrastructure. So the challenges you could imagine were around first getting past some of the different legacy systems. We were using Word as our manuscript tool, and we continue to do that. And then we were doing tagging, but it was not XML tagging. It wasn't, not angled brackets. It was a custom tool that was applying its own tagging constructs. And we were using that to get it into InDesign. It was based on a proprietary custom-built system. It required special training. We needed to keep, the Word plugins updated and deployed as Word versions changed. There was also no workflow solution for the interior content development, meaning people were keeping track of it using spreadsheets and other mechanisms, but there was no integrated workflow system that kept track of the status of the interior. There was a workflow solution for the cover workflow, but it did not handle any XML tagging or output. And so that's an ultimate goal, is that we could be able to tag any kind of content, interiors or covers, although I'll talk a little bit more about the scope specifically for this first and second phase of work. The ability to see where the content was is increasingly important, especially as we start to add new product lines that require different QA cycles and different people who need to view it. So, for instance, there are some folks who are reviewing the InDesign finals and covers and comps and whatnot, but there were also people that needed to review EPUB outputs and EPUB quality and then other merchandising collateral that needed to stay up to date with the latest interior and cover content. And so essentially, and this probably sounds familiar to many of you, is the InDesign was holding the content hostage, not just the cover, but especially for the cover, because a lot of that's merchandising or marketing material. And this has been sort of an age-old process where folks figured out ways to get access to that content. Now it's even more important to have the right version of that content digitally available for new channels as soon as in the process as able. So this is just a high-level diagram of the solution we employed, and it's a very simplified version of what we were trying to accomplish. Although it shows R Suite sort of in its own box, standing in the middle of this, from a workflow perspective, R Suite actually spans the entire process, keeping track of our manuscript receipt all the way through to final output of the print, EPUB, or any other multi-channel output that we wish to create. So that R Suite representation was really representing the transformation piece that we're doing with the RSI team, which is using data for publishers to convert the tagged Word using styles into an XML baseline, and then that XML is using, again, data for publishers, we transfer that into IDML through this in-copy XML process. We have in-copy up there as a box, reserving the right to allow editorial access to non-InDesign users that need to make updates, but as of this point, we've not actually implemented InCopy as a sort of a user-facing tool. But, we put it in there not only to have that option if we needed it, but also because we do need sometimes to make edits to the XML. And if we don't go all the way back to the Oxygen editor, for instance, that possibility does exist. But again, we're not using that quite that way as of now. And then you have the multi-channel output focused primarily on print and EPUB, but we can extract any XML and reuse that for whatever use profile we develop. And then MarkLogic is the underlying data repository where we store the XML for access throughout the process. There's also a Bilal database where they have existing tagged XML content, and we go through a bit of conversion and manage that through the R Suite process as well, and that's part of our focus in this next phase of work, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as we walk through sort of the timeline and where we're at within in the current process. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the team, because quite frankly, how you organize to do a project like this is incredibly important. And there are various different ways, and I've done several projects similar to this in my career, and there's sort of the all-inclusive, big, large team approach where you have 20 or 30 or more people, you know, all the people effectively focused on, not all of them, but all the key people from all the key divisions. And they participate, I've seen it taken more of a waterfall approach where you go and do a requirements gathering from all of them, and then you come back, with a validation of those requirements, and you move into sort of a build and deploy phase. We took a slightly different approach, which was agile based, and this is an approach that RSI has been very successful in developing solutions very quickly and very iteratively, and coming back and validating with the users that the direction we're heading in is being refined towards the ultimate outcome correctly, rather than going in and trying to anticipate all of the different needs, especially since the way the people will work changes significantly, and I'll talk a little bit more about that during the approach. But to get to the team aspect of this, it required a core team that was very, very small and compact. Basically, they were empowered to make decisions on behalf of the user basis to keep the RSI team, if they were configuring the RSI solution, it kept them moving along in what we called two-week sprints. And for those of you not familiar with the Agile approach, a sprint is basically a defined period of time that you commit to doing a certain number of user stories, which are kind of like scenarios or a list of requirements or capabilities that you would build out within the sprint window, 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 1 week. Ours happened to be what you call a cadence of 2 weeks. And we needed a core team that could interact on a daily basis with the RSI folks. And that consisted of a product owner out of our digital operations group, a business analyst who could work on what I would call the behind-the-screen capabilities, meaning the things you needed from a data perspective or a process perspective. We had a project manager, which is not typical within an Agile implementation. Instead, what you have is the next role, which is a Scrum Master, but the project manager role was there to make sure that the whole phase of work, we had a 12-week phase one, and I'll talk more about that as we go through the approach, but you have a 12-week phase with two-week sprints, but that lived inside of a multi-phase approach, managing other stakeholders and IT infrastructure folks, and so the project manager looked beyond the iterative Agile project, and I can talk a little bit more about that during lessons learned. And at first, quite frankly, it was a bit confusing because a lot of project managers, especially those familiar with Agile, they wanted to be the Scrum Master, and the Scrum Master in the meantime really wasn't going to focus on those things that were more coming out of the project management role, and it took a while, and then the product manager sometimes flexed in both directions, and so it was very important that early on during this process we sorted out those roles and responsibilities within the core team so that the product owner knew where their responsibilities ended and began, which was basically articulating what the business users needed in some priority order. And then the Scrum Master made sure that we were able to accomplish the defined body of work within the two-week sprint window. And then the project manager made sure that the sum of all the sprints was going to add up to progress towards the ultimate end goal, which was a completely deployed and supported system. We had folks out of our general books division, and now we're getting into So that product owner, BA, project manager, and scrum master, that was sort of the core team, the four people that met every day in the daily, what's called a scrum, the daily stand-up meeting, and spoke with the RSI team. Then we had the user representatives, or the power users, and they came out of production editorial and managing ed, a group called our electronic text management group, which was really the interior development team, ebook production, and then CDW was our old system and process for the cover digital or creative digital workflow, which really was cover digital workflow. And then within our Christian division, HCCP, we also had a project manager to oversee how the solution would be deployed and integrated and supported into their environment. And then they also had folks out of their books and graphic design, composition, and creative ops teams. Then we had what was called the extended team, and that was that group of folks that you would typically go to make sure you were covering all of their requirements and needs. And we brokered that through our core team. They were responsible for going back and socializing what we were doing and soliciting input. We had regular meetings with them to review the progress. So at the end of every two-week sprint, we would go back and do demos of what had been developed within the Agile method. And this team was, as it shows, an advisory team. They would provide input, they would answer questions, any subject matter expertise, and ultimately they would view the demos, test the system, and then approve us to move on for the next iteration of the development. And so it was, in a sense, a hybrid kind of implementation, because we did have a core team focused on agile delivery, iterative delivery of a solution, and then we had an extended team that ultimately validated when we were able to deploy. In some agile environments, you actually deploy to production each release. For us, we didn't do that. Our phase one, which was 12 weeks with two-week sprints, so six releases, we did not deploy those to production. We waited until phase two, and again, I'll talk a little bit more about that during the approach section, to start to focus on to deployments, and now we're in phase three, where we will do productive releases more frequently than at the end of 12-week phases. But we had a core focus team and then an extended team that ultimately would be the user base. So the approach, I already touched on some of this, but I want to get into some of the details on how we scoped it and managed the user expectations. Workflow, as I mentioned previously, there was no workflow system in place for interiors. Now, as you can imagine, there were certainly workflows in place, but they were different from one division to another, different between different operating groups, and they were tracked in different ways. Like I said, some people used email, some people used spreadsheets, some people had ancillary systems that tracked some of it, meaning they had information systems that had reporting and status, but there was no integrated, complete workflow tracking system that everyone had access to, which is what we were attempting to replace. Now, we didn't want to try to replace everything all at once, and so we had to narrow the scope to simple and medium complexity content, and we focused on interiors initially in phase one, leaving the cover approach to later, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. And so it was an interior workflow. It started with the receipt of the manuscript, basically the manuscript transmittal, so meaning that was the kind of kickoff event to start working on content development. So production would receive the manuscript from editorial, which started the workflow. We did design a baseline cover workflow in phase one, just to anticipate some of the complexity we might address in phase two, but we did not get into any development or iterative configuration of the system to do covers in the first phase. We intentionally left that to a future phase for a couple of reasons. One, they already had a workflow system, and we weren't going to be in a position to replace it wholesale. So we want, you know, right away. So we wanted to spend some time working on that. And so the focus was really more on the interiors. As I mentioned, on the content side, it was simple to medium complexity. The idea there was build a simple system that could handle our basic product, which was, you know, which represents the bulk of our product, simple to medium complexity. And then we would factor in ultimately more complex content later on. We did a little bit of discovery around some of the Bible content because it was so important to the Christian division, but we tried to really stick to the scoping for the development and configuration of the solution. We used R Suite workflow functionality right out of the box. There were very few modifications that needed to be made or customizations or extensions. We were able to go pretty much most of the way with the out-of-the-box capability. We did agree to focus on MS Word styling, which was a major change, and that's why that's bolded, because in the previous previous process, custom tagging was used and a custom plugin was used, and it was not Microsoft style based in one of our major divisions. In another division, it was hybrid. They used styles and the custom tagging, and then in another division, they used purely styles. So we kind of had a mixed bag, and we agreed to work on styles, which was very challenging for some of the folks early on to move from what amounted to a different tagging framework, and one that in some respects gave more flexibility on the front end to do different configurations, but it also created a maintenance challenge, a training challenge, a supportability challenge, because when you hired people in the market, freelancers or otherwise, you know, they were used to using Word styles. And it seemed like that's the direction the market has gone in general. If you look at most of the tagging-based solutions out there, there are some, of course, that use proprietary tagging and don't even use Word as an editor. But because we were married to using Word for our manuscript editing process, styling was the choice we made. Then we used XML conversions, and we're using Ditto for Publishers. And again, it was a very powerful framework and tool set for us, you know, that we did have to make our own and come up to speed on. And then ultimately that would move into InDesign, which is our composition environment, and we were not moving away from that. Again, there are some folks that have at other shops that use other composition engines and have moved away from InDesign, but we were committed to staying with InDesign as our composition engine. In terms of who, I talked a little bit about the team. And, you know, the production teams, managing ed, production editors, ebook teams, we tried to focus on the content development end of it. We did not include folks from the exploitation end or the marketing and merchandising end in this phase, because we were focused on tagging the content and making sure that we were getting the front end of the process right. And it was, like I said, a small team. And we were very focused on specific example titles, which I think was very important. You need to really agree on what simple and medium complexity means. It was usually obvious, but not always obvious, and there were shades of gray, and so we tried to focus on specific titles by examples. We also made sure that we had internal experts who could serve as trainer, not only because it forced us to be truly expert in the system, but it would create a support platform later when we bring on new users as we roll this out, and then they would train additional folks as they roll on. We worked very closely with RSI to create, you know, a training process for them that was sufficient. So RSI trained our trainers, and then our trainers are in the process of training our end users. In terms of the when, and maybe to frame the project from a much broader perspective, we started an RFP process last summer, and that actually took quite a bit of time. It was an extensive RFP process. We put this out to, I think the long list of vendors was more than 15. We narrowed that down to a short list that was less than 5, and ultimately had a bake-off between 2. And RSI was the unanimous winner across the divisions for both the workflow and the tagging solution. That process ended with selection in around the September timeframe, and then we had to go through some planning and discovery before we could kick off our agile approach in the December timeframe, November, December. And the holidays also made it challenging for anyone who's ever done a project during the holidays. It's challenging to think in 12-week chunks when you have breaks for Thanksgiving and Christmas. Especially, it's very important in Agile to establish a cadence where every 2 weeks you churn out another release. We were focused on ultimately a May release, but we were doing it in two, as I mentioned, two 12-week chunks. So phase one ended in about the February time frame, and then we went into a March, April, May, and we did deploy on time just a couple of weeks ago in late May. And that was a productive release, meaning we now have users on the system, and they're able to accept titles into the workflow process, and then we're doing tagging for the simple and medium complexity titles. Phase two, which is phase one was through February. Phase two, we did refine, take in input from the users. We added covers and cover workflow, and that is what resulted in the rollout for the May release. And so we did include, we do have the ability to cover workflows now, and we do have the ability to add larger groups of users and more titles as we go. The approach we're taking actually is to add titles as they come up on the pub schedule. We did not try to convert any content that was already in process, so we will sunset the old systems as we start and old processes as that content completes its development and routing cycle. So once that content's complete, we won't put any new content into the old systems other than the stuff that's of higher complexity or sits outside our the solution that we've created. Okay, so I think the lessons learned it was the most powerful thing, and in fact, I'll digress a little bit first from the people in process comments. The title of this is The Reality of Transformation Projects, and I think one of the early on discussions and debates was, you know, the level of transformation that the organization could indeed absorb or deal with. We had several large-scale initiatives going on concurrently, and so the advice I would give you is carefully consider what transformation means and also understand that transformation isn't really a project, it's a process. And although you can have projects that contribute to transforming your organization, projects have very specific start dates, end dates, scope, budgets. But transformation is an ongoing thing that spans projects and has to factor in all kinds of different things that your organization may or may not be going through. And so I would caution you with that. And that's really why what we learned from this project specifically in the context of all the other projects that were going out is that it has a lot more to do with the people and their processes than it did the system. And it's very easy to kind of stare at the system solution and poke holes in that and really focus on the system. But you could lose sight of the forest through the trees. And so you kind of need to start by knowing where you're heading, recognizing that it may not be, that vision on the horizon may be a little bit fuzzy because there are so many other changes going on. We were going through new locations, relocation of people. We were moving, I think, three of the four offices for the major divisions being impacted. We were changing a whole bunch of processes and systems that spanned a whole bunch of different groups. And so, in effect, it was transformational, but our project alone was not the only catalyst for that. And so we had to keep on thinking about the solution we were employing in the context of what all of those other things, all those other things that were going on, and especially avoiding what I would call, and it's an expression I'm sure you've heard, called repaving the cow path. We didn't just want to replace the old system and do it the same way. And so in a sense, the Agile method helped us again because we got to start from scratch with the most important things agreed upon, most important user scenarios, and implement iteratively from there, which meant we got to start, it wasn't a completely blank sheet of paper because people had experience making books and we were going to continue to make books, digital and physical. But the way we were going to go about doing that was up for discussion and debate. I think that was the second major lesson learned, is debate is good, but analysis paralysis is bad. And you really needed to stimulate a healthy debate to help give the team empowerment and give them the confidence to make decisions and recommendations, but you really needed them to be outcome focused, or you would end up in these sort of unending philosophical debates, and they didn't really lead towards productive solutions. They kind of led towards camps of thought, people thinking, we should do it this way or that way, but not because it was rationalized against the outcome or certain trade-offs. It was more because, well, this is the way we do it, or this is the way we need to do it. And we needed to sort of reframe that debate and change that lens. And it was difficult. But I think one of the best recommendations I can make is you need what I call the buck stops here person, the person who closes out those debates. Not everyone, everyone should be heard, but not everyone gets their way, essentially. And so you need someone who breaks the tie, or the impasse, more likely than that. And so you really need to identify that person early. It actually took us a while because we were both getting used to, some folks had never used the Agile method, and so they weren't used to the rapid pace. They felt like if we made a commitment to doing something and they didn't feel the debate had gone long enough that we missed an opportunity, that it was done, rather than we could iteratively refine the solution and address any gaps or any misses that may have come out of moving at that pace. And so having a person who could close out the debate and reassure the team that ultimately the solution would work if they just hung in there and waited out the process, it was important to identify that person early. It took us a little longer, like I said. Once we did, we started moving much more quickly, and folks felt like it was fair because they were still able to be heard, but they still had to compromise. And then things became much more straightforward, what the system could do, and there was so much flexibility in the RSI platform, both on the workflow and on the tagging side, that really what it came down to was optimizing the different options and the different possibilities. And again, debate, but then solution-oriented. And so we tried to put a problem-solving method in that focused on the implications of one option over another, got the team towards a recommendation as best we could, and then the buck stops here person, they would drive that decision. And they would force us to make up our mind. We couldn't just sit on the fence and debate and debate and debate and go back and forth. We really needed to move forward and get into the next phase, the next sprint. And so I think that's really important. And that for those of you that have been involved in large-scale projects or even small-scale prototyping initiatives, because this effectively was a large-scale project that we implemented in a small team, small-scale, agile way, iteratively. So it was kind of, addressing the certainty of making books for multi-channel output, but the uncertainty of how we might do that to make trade-offs for transparency in separate teams. And in the end, it was much more about people and process, the trade-offs. The system comes in line once you've articulated your priorities and where you want to head. So this is a bit of a controversial term. What does pseudo-agile mean? I mean, basically what it means is the agile method is fairly well articulated, and there are all kinds of, there are different agile methods out there, and Scrum is one of the more popular ones you've heard of. But what pseudo-agile means is not everyone comes to the project. In a pure agile engagement, everyone is trained, they understand their roles, they implement in an agile method. Well, we had people that had never done agile, had never been trained on agile, and so we had to accommodate them within the method. And so RSI was delivering under an agile methodology. Every 2 weeks they were going to deliver a functional release of the solution to us. What we needed to do was work within and then around their agile method. To keep our stakeholders up to date, to keep our extended team engaged and involved and not nervous, to keep even our core team, because even our core team had disparate skills. Some were more familiar with Agile than others. And so we needed to make sure that we were addressing the trade-offs in a way that a pure Agile team wouldn't be offended by it, because that is the Agile method. You make trade-offs in order to iteratively develop a solution that becomes better and more refined over time. But in an organization that's much more familiar with waterfall, where you go in and you discuss the requirements for a very, very long time until you agree to them and prioritize them, and then they get built based on those detailed specifications and requirements lists, they were much less comfortable with this iterative approach, where we would have to make up differences, you know, make up the differences later. We would trade off and make up differences later. We had to be honest about that, that the Agile methodology works, but we needed to be able to help the team deal with the cadence. It says here, help the team find their cadence. That actually wasn't negotiable. We kept and are still keeping within a two-week cadence. We took one break during deployment so that we could focus specifically on any post-production support issues. We haven't had any major issues, and in fairness, we haven't ramped up the amount of content and users, so we're bringing folks on and training them, and so it's a very soft launch, I would call it, but otherwise the cadence and the speed was defined. We were going to move within 2 week release cycles, and the way we did that was by making sure we balanced the scope and what was included in each 2 week release. I think on the roles, you really need to be very clear. We did a RACI exercise, which, for those of you who have never done a RACI chart, it stands for Responsible, Accountable, Consulted, and Informed, and it's really for articulating both roles and how you communicate to people. And we went through a RACI exercise, and we still ran into trouble differentiating between product managers, project managers, and scrum masters. I think you want to be as clear as you can be up front on who has what roles, but by who has the ball or which ball. What I mean by that is there are still deliverables within the Agile method. There are still different artifacts the team needs, including the user stories and more detailed requirements specifications. You need to be really clear on who owns it and then who's responsible and then who's ultimately accountable versus who's consulted or informed. And the areas where I would caution you is there's a lot of overlap between BAs and product managers. In a lot of organizations, BAs play a role similar to the product manager, which is they help to represent the user requirements. But it's more about perspective. In an agile development, the product manager typically comes from the user ranks and is a representative of those users from a user perspective, as opposed to a BA who ultimately probably won't be a user, but they are interpreting requirements in order to inform the solution team on the options, you know, the implications, options, and recommendations. But there's a lot of overlap between those two roles. Same thing with the project manager. Product managers, very strong product managers, sometimes also wear that project management hat, which in any methodology is typically a conflict of interest because product managers advocate for the users and will make different choices sometimes than a project manager who also has to advocate for other stakeholders, including finance and IT, where other compromises have to be made. And so there's a fine line sometimes between product managers and project managers. And then Scrum Master is really the person who's managing the day-to-day, week-to-week, team-based performance. So there's an overlap between a Scrum Master and a project manager. In fact, most Agile implementations, they don't have project managers because you're very product-focused and you're delivering iteratively that product. Any other ancillary services are negotiated by the Scrum Master with other groups, but there is not always or not typically a project manager. As I mentioned earlier, we needed that because this was a multi-phase project occurring in the midst of a portfolio of other related projects, and we needed that project manager to make sure this project stayed connected to that. But we needed the Scrum Master to execute two-week sprints in a cadence. And so these key tasks and deliverables to the last point there, some of them sit outside the core team and the Agile process, and the examples are setting up the environments, training, making sure that there are other issues that escalate beyond. So, for instance, we would need a metadata feed that would come from one of our master systems. Well, that's a system that was also going through a refactoring and replacement. And so these are examples of things that sit outside of the Agile team's purvey, so to speak, but they're dependent on them. And so we used our project manager for that. And so, like I said, I wanted to try to make sure we kept enough time for questions from you folks. And so that's where we arrived at, 35 seconds early, I think.
Great job, Mike. Yeah, we covered a lot of ground, but we have some good questions here for you. One of them has to do with the importance you mentioned of designating a buck stops here person, and one of the, or actually two of the questions are around that. And the question is, who is that person, and was it different in different phases or different processes? That what group did they come from?
So for us, it came out of our digital operations group. It was actually a person who used to work in my group, helping to deploy both new digital supply chain capabilities and support and provide some triage and operational support. That person subsequently moved into the content and production production operations group. And so she was playing the sort of aggregating product manager role. And I will caution you again, her buck stops here input was around both the relative priorities of things we were building and ultimately driving the decision against the options and recommendations. She didn't, and this is where you want to have clear governance between your product manager and your scrum master, she didn't have the authority to increase the volume of capability in a sprint or decrease it. That you want the scrum master to broker that. So I want to be very clear that the buck stops here was more around the philosophical debate around what we were doing. When it came to the actual solution, then the Agile team works together on the how you do it, and you have to empower them. And a lot of that authority or a lot of that guidance and input came from the RSI team on how to best use the software and the solution. But the buck stops here person was a business person who represented the broader user groups.
I see. And you touched on this briefly, but another question is whether you think this approach and framework would work well if scaled down for a much smaller publisher than HarperCollins.
Absolutely. I think it could work for any size organization. There's this misnomer. In fact, it's ironic. Normally the question is the other way around. Can Agile work for large organizations? Because Agile is a methodology that is typically deployed when folks have very small, high-performing teams. It's used a lot by startups and small companies, but it is also increasingly being used by large companies. It's really more, and it's funny because some people think that Agile and Waterfall are so completely different, but there's probably as many similarities as there are differences in the methods. So I would strongly encourage you to look into the Agile methodology to debunk some of the myths, which is, it doesn't scale, it doesn't produce scalable systems, and, these are just not true. These are myths.
I see. And we have a question about how will you handle corrections to legacy titles, which were done with the old MS Word tags?
So it's funny you should mention that. They mapped out a reprints and corrections approach, but we think we're going to tinker with it because it needs to basically stand the test of a productive deployment. So we mapped it out on paper, but basically we want to go back to as early in the process as possible. The debate was whether to go all the way back to Word and run the transforms again or do it in XML. Obviously there are efficiencies in XML, but then the question is on the operational scale side, some of the early content owners and manuscript folks, they won't work in Oxygen, they won't work natively in XML. And so we will likely end up, depending on the nature and volume of the changes, with a hybrid solution. In fact, that's why we had InCopy down. We might even entertain, depending on the volume and the nature of the edits, updates further down in the process. But the goal is to go back at least as far so that any changes we make are available in the XML so that we have, any reprints and corrections flowing through to all of our products and that we don't have to duplicate that effort for each channel, the output, print, and digital.
I see. Since we're talking about some of the details here, there's another question on that. I think it was slide 8. It says, in your solution diagram, you have an arrow from RSuite to EPUB. Does that mean it does not go through InDesign first. The manuscript has to be final for EPUB and before InDesign for print.
Correct. It does not have to. It does not have to go through InDesign for an EPUB output.
I see. Thank you. And Sorry, I
accidentally switched the slide there when I refreshed my screen.
Okay. And what are some good upstreaming, or sorry, what are some good upstream authoring solutions to tie into a CMS DAM? Is that
I think that's a tricky one, and that was part of our challenge on the RFP process. I mean, we had really made a decision, and we were challenged on this. We had really made a recommendation, I should say, it led to a decision that we were going to stick with Word as our primary authoring tool. There are so many publishers out there that had built their own solution. They had licensed software from other proprietary solutions. There are software as a service solutions out there. So I'd rather not name all of the different ones that are out there for the simple matter of there's no shortage of them, and it really depends on what problem you're trying to solve. We were not trying to solve we were not trying to open up the possibility of moving away from Word, although, again, we were challenged to consider that. But, when I talk about the broader transformational challenges, getting your authors and your agents and your editors to work outside of Word can be a significant challenge. And so we were not taking that on definitively in this effort. But like I said, other folks have. So for us, it's Word.
I see. And we have a couple questions at the organizational level. What main processes were used to justify the cost-benefit to this change?
I think a big part of it was that the legacy systems were increasingly becoming unsupportable. I think the other was that we were trying to reconfigure and relocate teams, and we needed to be able to make sure that everyone was working from a consistent set of tools and capabilities so that we could scale it out from there. But I think the bigger driver was that the old systems just weren't fit to the task and they were not maintainable, and there were too many of them.
I see. Kind of piggybacking on that, this attendee asks, the consensus is important, but for CMS project, does it make more sense to get initial buy-in from the product design team, the finance team, editorial? Is there one place you started?
That one's tricky because ultimately you need every stakeholder. You need to address every stakeholder's questions or their points of resistance. I think you certainly need to have a strong sponsor on the service delivery side, meaning the content development team, because they're the ones that are going to be at the nexus of change. So I think you really need to start with them. They need to be prepared both through top-down and bottom-up support in going through this change process. And then obviously you're affecting very early on the interaction with the editors and the authors, and so you need to reassure them that you're not going to derail it. Now, we avoided that by not taking on the Word, a move away from Word, because they got to stay in their comfort zone. You were increasing some of the transparency because you're starting to expose workflows that could kind of, go through a less transparent process. I guess I should be honest and say we'll see how well we're doing with that change element as we deploy more and more titles, because I think you're going to have to make sure that they see the system and they understand the system and they trust the system. But selling them in during the early part of the process that you'll be able to make content faster, make collateral content available sooner, certainly satisfies the marketing and publicity and other merchandising folks. And so I think it's kind of in that order that it's which kind of makes sense, I think, if you think about the way people are looking at the content as it's acquired and then developed and then deployed. It's the folks that are going to build the content, but then the folks you're building the content for, editors and authors, and then ultimately the folks that are reusing the content to help sell and market it. And so you need all of them on board, but we chose that particular order from a sponsorship, an internal momentum building perspective, but ultimately you need a participation from all of them.
Can you talk a little bit about how how you dealt with resistance from a team that explores every angle before starting a project and helping them ease into the pseudo-agile mindset or flow?
It was tricky. I think you have to go through, you know, that well-known, hopefully well-known group dynamic of storming, norming, conforming, and performing. And so we had to go through that, and it was hard. There were some knockdown, drag-out battles, and some recycling of the team to get folks to, you know, to get moving forward, to get past the debate, and get on with the solution. And so you need to provide enough time in the beginning, but then you need to, you know, to bring it to closure. You can't stay in storming forever.
Mm-hmm. Are external collaborators like typesetters and authors involved in the system, and if so, how?
Ultimately, authors will, but early on right now, we're going to be going through the same process we go through where they won't necessarily be on the system seeing the workflow, but they will be interacting through the editorial cycles where the Word document is being edited and passed around. The goal, ultimately, is that we can make the workflows more transparent and more accessible to any stakeholders at any point in the process, meaning we'll drive as much self-service as we can, but we are still a very high author care shop, and we want to make sure that we're not adding burden or work to our authors. You know, that's the service we're providing them. But in terms of other collaborators and freelancers and other folks outside the shop, absolutely the goal is to make both the transparency of the workflow process and then the content artifacts available for exchange throughout the process.
I see. And a question about metadata. How many meta tags did you include in your XML version per title? Did you heavily tag your content for greater discoverability?
The initial focus is very much on content structure to get it into InDesign, and in future phases we'll address additional tagging constructs to drive discovery and merchandising. That's a little bit more of a complex process that needs attention to other things like semantics and ontologies and other discovery and merchandising objectives. And so since we were very much focused on the content development side of it, we need to nail that down first. And then we'll move to some of those other adventures.
I see. And in terms of, you did go over this, and it was included in one of the slides, but in terms of the so far how long this project has been going, phase one started in last summer? Is that correct?
Well, that's when the RFP process started, but the actual implementation phase didn't start until the October-November time frame, meaning we did some discovery a little bit in September. We wrapped up discovery and planning, which is basically, even with an agile method, you have to go in with an inventory of user stories to start the team to develop for their first two-week sprint. And so we probably had a 4 to 6 week, and it dragged on a little bit, so it was probably closer to 8 weeks of nailing down scope and approach and teams and logistics and other things. So we probably kicked off our first agile sprint in the, I want to say, October-November time frame, because it was 12 weeks with a couple of breaks for the holidays, and we ended up in the February time frame ending that first 12-week phase.
I see. And what kind of final product release schedule did your system have to be able to support, as in how many products over a given time?
Well, it'll start out small because it's a trickle. We'll take simple to medium complexity titles, which is a handful of titles that are available for publication. In fact, our first titles will enter the system, you know, this week and next week, or over the next several weeks, and then we'll ramp up over time. And you know, the total number of titles will be based on the divide or whatever the percentage that fit that simple to medium complexity, but certainly we'll start out in the tens of titles, and then we'll work our way up from there when we get closer to the end of the calendar year, when we're able to move all of the simple to medium complexity titles out of the old process and all the new titles into the new process.
I see. Here's another question.
Tens of titles per much as they, that's per week, not per year. Obviously, we're a big house, and we do hundreds of titles a year.
Right. Can you talk about the choice of DITA versus the NLM JATS tag set, and that's a little bit beyond my area, but hopefully you can answer that.
I think we have done a diagnostic last year, and we realized you could probably get really scientific, and for some of the publishing verticals that have much more complicated tagging needs, you'd probably need to do a much more detailed and thorough bake-off of the different frameworks. For us, it was a very short debate, meaning with the help of some outside consultants, we did evaluate some of the pros and cons. But DITA is fairly well established. It's fairly straightforward. It's very flexible. It's been implemented in many, many different shops, and it was a fairly obvious choice for us. So the debate for us was short. I think, if you're in science, technical, and medical, and educational content, and other more complicated content, I think you're going to need to have a more thoughtful debate on your content tagging needs.
Okay, thank you. We have a couple more minutes, so I'll try to get a couple more questions in. One is, are your EPUBs templated with a CSS since they don't use any InDesign styling?
Yes, and that's one of the areas we're going to focus on now is some of the specific work around EPUB 3 and EPUB processing, basically. So we started, obviously we had to do some baseline work on that, but now we will increase our focus on that, especially as we and the industry move towards EPUB 3 as the new standard.
I see. And what InDesign are you working with?
Which version?
Yeah.
Got me there. I knew you'd stump me with at least one question, but I'm not an InDesign user, so I couldn't tell you that.
That's okay. Let's see. Another question. If development is linear, it could get stuck with someone. If simultaneous, how does version control work? Can you answer that?
I think that's always a tricky thing with workflow systems. Our size workflow solution gives you the ability to assign quick tasks. So part of it is just being vigilant and watching the workflow and having someone who is making sure that things are moving along. And you should be keeping track of whether someone's out of the office, for instance, or whether there are more than one person that needs to provide input. The vast majority of the steps are linear, but if you do have steps where multiple people need to look at it, then you really need to clarify it from a process and workflow perspective. No matter how many rules you build in, you might end up building a much more complex system than you actually need, because most of those folks know how to work in parallel. Now all you're doing is making sure that the system isn't confusing anyone as to who has the ball. And so again, quick tasks was one of the things that allowed you to assign tasks to other folks. Check in, check out works basically the way most versioning systems work, where only one person can have the master, and so that you can't have conflicts, but that does mean you have to go back and reconcile differences. The system will let you know if someone is trying to work on something that they shouldn't be because they're not in charge of the master. But we didn't try to address very complex, parallel workflows, primarily because we didn't see the need for that in these early phases. As we go along, we'll have to come up with different solutions depending on how complex it gets.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to have to need to wrap things up. Had a lot of great questions from our attendees. I want to thank you, Mike. It was a great presentation. On behalf of Book Business and our suite CMS, I want to thank everybody for attending today's webinar. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all our archived and upcoming webinars. And I hope to see you all at the next Book Business webinar.